And good morning. Life Matters with your morning cuppa, great way to start the day, I'd say. Lovely to have you with us. Natasha Mitchell joining you for the next hour here on RN. You'll meet Fawn Weaver this morning. Now, she's founded what's called the Happy Wives Club, a global online community that's taken off. Marriage gets a bad rap, and she really wants to do something about that. And her book about why debuted at number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list earlier this year, which kind of says something, doesn't it, about the appeal of what she's saying. What exactly is she saying? We're going to find out later on the show. And on the Life Matters Facebook page, quite a heated discussion unfolding there, as we thought it might, about whether the value of your house should be included in the assets test that determines whether or not you get the aged pension. Union leader Paul Howes has called for this to happen, and you certainly have something to say about that. Joining us will be the CEOs of the Grattan Institute and of National Seniors Australia to respond to that argument put forward by Paul Howes. That's coming up in the show. Stay with us. Well, the National Disability Insurance Scheme make a difference in your household. It's now being trialled in some states. Won't be fully national until 2016, though. And the aim here, of course, is to put the power firmly in your hands for you to use an individual funding allocation to pay for the services you most need when you need them. A new wheelchair or specific care to help you get up and to work each day. Really to tailor your needs. And it's about control and choice for people and their carers. Great in principle. What about the practicalities and the logistics that will take in your life? Disability specialists met for a symposium in Brisbane on Monday to review how the new scheme is being implemented and the challenges of moving from that old model of service delivery to this new one. I'm joined this morning by Cathy Rees. She's a disability consultant and CEO of a company which helps people manage so-called self-directed care packages, which really stemmed from her daughter's experience, as we'll hear. And Leslie Chenoweth is Professor of Social Work at Griffith University, amongst other roles. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Natasha. Great to be here.
And hello, Natasha, as well.
Hello there. Leslie, it's early days for the National Disability Insurance Scheme. What was the focus of what sounded like a very practical discussion this week at the symposium?
Yes, Natasha. We organised this symposium to bring together all of the major stakeholders that are really for whom the NDIS is really going to make a major change in their lives. So, and we had also researchers and scholars who've also been thinking and working along about all of the issues that are inherent in it. So we really wanted to provide an opportunity to bring all those people together and to hear what people's understandings were, what their concerns were, what they were excited about. And we initially thinking we'd have 60 people for a measured discussion, had just under 200.
And was it measured?
Well, I felt, yes, yeah. It was measured, yeah. But it was certainly robust.
Can we be quite specific here? I mean, in principle, Leslie, self-management sounds ideal, and this is what people have been lobbying for many years. But what sorts of skills have come up, or concerns about the skills that people will need to make it work for themselves?
I think that's a really key issue. Certainly everyone is very excited about this scheme, and it represents one of the biggest, most positive shifts in this country. But I think there is some confusion around, well, what do I need to do? And this really represents a shift not just in the technical skills. It represents a shift in how we think about support. Because for many, many years, decades, people with disabilities and families, many of them have had a service, this is what you get, and it's really about learning more about, well, how do I prepare? What sort of life do I want? And how do I prepare for that?
Big shift, isn't it?
A very big shift.
Give us some of those dimensions. I mean, it's bigger than just a conceptual shift. It is a fundamental shift in the skills you'll need in terms of financial planning, you know, managing the logistics of service providers coming into your life or into the person's life that you care for.
Yes. So there are many, many elements to it. But I think also people need to be thinking about what level of control do I really want? Mm. A lot of the parents and people with disabilities that we know and work alongside, it's like having a full-time job because you manage the money, you have to account for the money, you recruit, you train staff. And those are the sorts of things that people used to just have to have what the service delivered.
Mm. With now, all the limitations that came with that.
Exactly. And I think it's this balancing up how much control, but how much work is that going to mean? Mm. Now, I think we also, though, need to take into account that hundreds of families and people with disabilities have been doing this and doing it very, very well. Mm. And there's a lot we could learn from those people about what to avoid, and that's some of the work that Kathy and I and others at Griffith are doing.
Well, you are one of those people, Kathy Rees.
Yes, I am.
You got very practical and very strategic very early on. Tell us about your daughter, Bea, because you run effectively her own personal care package, and this all started for you with an accident when she was 9.
Yes, that's right. That was a long time ago. She's now 40. And the responsibilities that I've had in supporting her quality of life and to give her the best life that I possibly could really kick-started in the early 1990s when her settlement came through. And I did that at a time when there were no real restrictions around what could be done and what couldn't be done. And then I formalised that in 2000 with a structure and formalised all of that.
What do you mean by formalised? We should just explain. She was in an accident, and
that's
so
right,
you got a payout for that.
That's right.
She was left very, very disabled indeed.
Yes, that's correct. It meant, you know, in order to facilitate the employment of staff and, you know, managing the funds, etc. I've done that in conjunction with others, obviously. But the management of staff and what have you, I've done that through initially a very informal business structure and then formalised it into a company. So I'm one of the people out there that one of the parents and people with disabilities I've certainly met when I did the Practical Design Fund project last year, people who've set up company structures in order to, you know, meet the legislative and regulatory requirements to be able to manage this on our own.
Now, you mentioned the Practical Design Fund. We'll come to that. But can you describe, because this is what people will need to hear, how this kind of business model, if you like, that you've set up for your personal situation, how that shapes your day-to-day lives? Like what are you buying in? What sorts of services are you buying in for your daughter, Bea?
Well, over the years, it's been mainly support staff, but it's also been external providers, you know, people with other specialist experience that my support workers don't have. This is about really tailoring and shifting the supports for Bea as her needs have changed.
Well, what sort of supports does Bea need?
Well, it's pretty much everything because she can't physically do anything. She's a person with high-level quadriplegia. She's brain blind. She can't speak. She has multiple forms of epilepsy. It sounds like all the troubles in the world. She's a very strong-willed woman in amongst all of that. So the supports have to be very personalised to what she can cope with. And sometimes that's actually changed. In the last year or so in particular, she's been diagnosed with a neurogenic bladder, which is something that's quite traditional for people with a spinal injury, and she has a deteriorating sleep disorder. So she can stay awake for 2 days and two nights.
Oh, ouch.
And it's like it's really weird living with that now.
Yeah.
And I've had to walk with the staff and make the adjustments to the support. So for my role of being both the employer and the director of the company as well as the mum, sometimes that's a pretty hard division.
It sounds hard. I mean, you started this all very early and you were very strategic, obviously, and it might overwhelm some people to think that they might set up a business to manage all this for their loved one. But what skills did you need to pick up in order to manage your needs and your daughter's needs?
I think it would be fair to say that the skills I had at the beginning were very, very minor, apart from having a very strong commitment to a good life for my daughter. I have friends who have other skills, and I was quite okay about asking for help. One of my friends had been a service provider and she went on to do a degree in commerce, and she certainly looked at the other things as I was asking for things or talking about things. She'd bring in ideas and external types of knowledge to help me. I guess when we're talking about people self-directing, we need to be aware that we don't have to know everything, but it's okay to go and ask for help and to ask amongst our networks, and whether it's our neighbours, our friends, people know people. And it doesn't have to be in standard service delivery land that we go finding the answers.
Professor Leslie Chenoweth, now people listening to Kathy's story will go, God, I don't have the ability to set up a business. So do you expect that many people will be looking to specialist agencies, a sort of a middle person to navigate the system and, in a sense, broker the services for them?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think Kathy's journey.
I'm agreeing with that.
Kathy's nodding. I think her journey's been exceptional. However, I think certainly there should be a range of ways that people can come to this. And often it is a developmental process. So in other countries, there are models where there are brokers who operate, there are certainly disability organisations that have kind of shifted the whole way they think to provide various levels of self-management. So I think sometimes it's useful to think of it as there'll be people like Kathy who'll say, I want the money, I can control all of this, I'm setting up a company or I'm doing whatever and I'm fine. There'll be other people right down the other end who'll say, this is all too hard, I'm happy with this kind of service package, and that's what they'll do. They will still purchase that from a disability provider and perhaps other organisations or services, and then in the middle there'll be a whole spectrum.
Yes, that's right. You alluded, Leslie, to international experiences. So we're sort of further, we're kind of earlier down the track. But say, for example, England, they have a self-managed scheme in place. What has worked in their system that we can learn from right now, early on in this process?
I think, well, certainly one of the things that I've taken from that those studies is that the need for good information is really key, because once people are confused, then, you know, that sets you back. So I think providing really sound, solid information that's very accessible for everyone, that's really key. I think, too, that it will also require those people, professionals working in the sector, to really understand this as well, because that represents a big paradigm shift from how typically, you know, professionals, you know, where we are the expert and this is what you need. It's changing the whole power base. So there's been a lot of findings and research that's come out of the UK about how do we shift a workforce to accommodate and to work in this new way. But certainly I think the information is key, and I think we also need to start to think about, and some people are already doing this.
You'd hope so.
Safeguards around people who are quite vulnerable.
and making sure that they get the services they need,
yes.
and indeed the increasing services they need as
yes.
needs increase, as in your case,
yes.
Kathy. We have to let you go, but this has been great just to open up this discussion, and I think we might revisit this and tease out some of the real specifics of some of the questions we've raised today, perhaps with you both and with others as well. If you'd like to join us again, I'd love that.
Yes, well, we'd like to stay onto this topic because it's all rolling out.
That's right. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor
yes.
Leslie Chenoweth at Griffith University, and Kathy Rees, a disability consultant and mother of Bee. Thank you.
Thank you, Natasha.
And you might be able to help us guide us. You might help us guide through some story ideas on the National Disability Insurance Scheme. So if there are particular issues that you'd like us to tease out, we'd like to hear from you this year, and we might be able to help get that information that's needed. Don't overwhelm us, but strategic stories we'd really like to follow up on. And you're with Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. abc.net.au/rn, and look for Life Matters is our website if you'd like to get in touch via email. 02833 1430 is our listener feedback line. Now, should the family home be means tested as part of the decision as to whether you get the pension? That's coming up next.
Now available online. By Design looks at Chinatowns around the world.
This is almost a heritage precinct that commemorates a stylized memory of a more traditional Chinese society. This is an exotic fake, if you like, commemoration of that group of Sydneysiders who've been here since the 1850s.
That's By Design with me, Fenella Kernebone. Have a listen anytime at the RN website.
How's your budget looking? Too much spending? Not enough revenue? That's certainly the situation facing the federal government as they prepare for the May budget. So one of the outlays they've decided to scrutinise is spending on welfare. Controversially, the age pension has been quarantined from their review, a significant omission according to some economists, because the age pension accounts for one third of the federal welfare budget, almost 10% of the entire federal budget, and that's been on the increase as the population ages. Well, this week the Australian Workers Union National Secretary Paul Howes weighed into the debate in a provocative opinion piece in the Fin Review. He argues that the means test for pensioners must include the family home to stop the owners of million-dollar dwellings taking taxpayers' money that he argues could be better directed to needier pensioners. Well, for different perspectives on this proposal, we have John Daly. He's the CEO of the Grattan Institute and lead author on a major report into the budget pressures facing governments. It was released last year before the federal election. And also with us is the Chief Executive of National Seniors Australia, Michael O'Neill. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Good morning, Natasha.
Michael, let me start with you. What's your response to Paul Howe's argument that as part of the assets means test for whether or not you receive the pension, the value of your home should be taken into account?
Look, my reaction is that I think Paul's floated, and indeed John's Institute has provided similar commentary in the past, is that it really fails to understand the significance of the home, the family home, in a social, cultural and economic sense to Australians, and particularly to older Australians. I think it is readily identified as low-hanging fruit in any exercise of this kind, but that low-hanging fruit has with it some really significant implementation issues for the kind of changes that Paul Howes has proposed, and also some implications for people. And a couple of brief examples of that. The overwhelming, my sense of our folk who are members, and indeed the broader over 50s and 60s community, is people regard their family home as the basis for their long-term care. That is, when you age and inevitably will end up in some form of aged care, whether it's home or residential, increasingly people will be paying for that, and the family home very much provides the foundation for that taking place. So to move to essentially force people to sell the family home, to in some way draw down the value of it, I think is short-sighted and fails to recognise its longer-term intent. And perhaps two other brief points. I notice the Grattan Institute has talked about a range of ways that the budget challenge could be dealt with, but it notes in some of its arguments that the execution risks are very high. Now, I would suggest that with the family home, execution risks are really high there as well.
But Paul House makes the comment that one's principal residence is not hypothetical money, it's wealth, plain and simple. Those are his words. And certainly, according to Grattan Institute figures, around half of pension spending goes to households with more than $500,000 in net assets. 4 in 5 mature-age households with around $1 million in assets are getting an average of $200 per week in welfare payments. Isn't there a case, Michael, for at least considering whether this is well-targeted money?
Look, I don't think there's an issue with considering it, but before you get to considering it, you need to look at part of that, just how you go about drawing it down. All good and well for Paul House to talk about it, and he then floats the idea of a reverse mortgage scheme floated by managed by the government or backed by the government. I mean, the previous government had...
Well, that was floated by the Productivity Commission.
And House has picked it up and tried to run with it, so it's not original. The previous government rejected that in the aged care reform process. The current government, I'd suggest to you, is most unlikely to go down that path.
We might
Can I say more generally, Natasha, if we're going to get into this space, and what disappoints me about the focus on the family home, is that it's only in the aged context. So if we want to get into this space, then let's have a look at proper tax reform. Let's have the Grattan Institute and Paul Howes start to tackle things like capital gains tax on the family home across the lifespan of people.
Okay.
Let's have a look at negative gearing and the cost of that. Let's just not focus on older Australians with their limited capacity to deal with these kind of changes.
Well, the Grattan Institute has been mentioned a couple of times, so let's come to the CEO of the Grattan Institute, John Daly. John, what's your response to Paul Howe's argument?
I think it's a really good sign that we're starting to talk about this more seriously. I can well understand why somebody who has a family home, has $1 million in assets and is nevertheless getting an age pension says, well, that's my entitlement. I've worked hard all my life and I would like to keep it. If I were in that situation, that's exactly what I would say too.
And also, when you think about it, it doesn't take much for even the most basic house to be worth $1 million in some capital cities in Australia now.
Well, and one of the real issues here is that people who bought their houses before about 2000 essentially got an enormous bonus out of the big run-up we've had in house prices, essentially, as interest rates came down. So we've seen a very large, probably one-off increase in Australian houses and in Australian house prices. Now, that's terrific if you're on the right side of it. And, of course, it's one of the reasons why younger people are now really struggling to buy a house. And we're seeing home ownership rates, even amongst 45-year-olds, falling quite rapidly. So as I said, I can well understand why people say, you know, I've got $1 million house, I've worked hard all my life, and I'm entitled to keep it. But the problem is we have to look at the much bigger picture here. We have a budget which is in significant trouble. We see ever increasing spending on health, which is particularly for older people, and we want to be able to keep doing that. What are the alternatives here? The alternatives are, well, either we say everyone else is simply going to have to pay more tax, or we say that we are simply going to stop paying for health. That doesn't seem very attractive. Or we say we're going to try and look at other things. Now, Michael's mentioned that we can look at other things, and indeed Grattan Institute has in terms of things like negative gearing. We think that's absolutely something that could afford to go. Looking at capital gains tax on family homes has a whole series of actually much, much more difficult implementation issues, and that's probably not a direction we'd suggest.
Well, let's just give people a real sense of how critical is the age pension in terms of the ongoing budget pressure on government spending?
Well, so far, we've seen the age pension increase, spending on the age pension increase by about $13.5 billion over the last decade. I think the popular perception is that that's because the population is older, and of course that's true. That accounts for about $5 billion of it. But another $3 billion is because we index it at weekly earnings rather than CPI. And then another $5.5 billion is because we have expanded the eligibility for it and we've substantially increased the rates. So there have actually been very substantial increases in the age pension, not because of ageing, but because of, you know, positive decisions to make it larger.
Well, that was from a very low base, though. I mean, people eking out an existence on a pension who very much need the pension would not be arguing that they're particularly well off.
Well, and I think one of the huge issues here is that in the rest of the Australian welfare system, we have the most tightly targeted welfare system in the world. So welfare goes to people who really need it and not to people who don't. The age pension is an exception to that. Some of it goes to people who really need it. And I have no doubt that if you do not own your own house and your only source of income is the age pension, chances are you're doing it pretty tough. However, we have people who have other sources of income, who own their own house and are not paying rent, and I suspect that their need for the age pension is much less. And that's what we are saying. The rest of the Australian welfare system is highly targeted. That's why we can afford it. The age pension is much less tightly targeted. And let's look at mechanisms that, so that we can tighten up the targeting of it, so that we can afford all the other things we'd like to be able to do.
But the issue here, John Daly, is that you can be asset rich but cash poor when you're sitting on a house. And so to use the house as a vehicle for means testing for the pension can really probably put quite a few people in a real pickle.
And that's exactly why the mechanism that the Productivity Commission, the Henry Review and Paul Howes and ourselves have been talking about is conceptually it's a reverse mortgage, although it's a reverse mortgage to the government. And of course one of the beauties of that is that you can say, well, the government will always ensure that you have at least, say, $500,000 of equity in your own house that you retain. We won't take any more than that. If you get to the point where that's the only asset you have left, you wind up qualifying for the pension as normal. But what we are saying is that for people who have substantially more assets than that, and as you mentioned, if people with $1 million in assets over the age of 65, four in five of them are still claiming an age pension. For people in that situation, the government can effectively draw down on the value of the house. The government looks after the reverse mortgage. That means it will never get out of control. That means you'll always retain a substantial equity in your house. But it also means that we'll essentially be saying to some people who can afford to contribute that they should.
John Daly, the CEO of the Grattan Institute, is with me this morning, as is Michael Daly, Chief Executive of National Seniors Australia. We're responding to a discussion provoked by Paul Howes, the Australian Workers' Union National Secretary, in an opinion piece in the Fin Review, where he's suggesting that the value of your home should be included in the assets means test to determine whether you get the pension or not. Michael O'Neill from National Seniors Australia, let's come back to this idea floated by the Productivity Commission and indeed by the Grattan Institute for a kind of reverse mortgage in order to help fund your own pension. The description that John gives of that whole approach doesn't necessarily leave people any worse off, and it gets us out of a pickle in terms of the burden to the federal budget of the growing pension expense.
Well, I think there's a couple of things to that. Reverse mortgages are not new. They've been around for some time. And they failed in the marketplace. The funding costs associated with it, its attractiveness or otherwise to consumers, meant that it failed to grow from the early 2000s, collapsed in 2008 when the GFC occurred, and really hasn't resurrected since then. Only one of the major banks plays in that space at the moment, and only in a minor way. Now, I think that's a message about the attractiveness of that kind of scheme to Australians and indeed globally to people. So there's really important challenges to be met there. Perhaps the better way of going about it may well be to consider the kind of disincentives that there are for people at the moment to downsize their property. So if you do have your million-dollar house and you need you have the need for the cash, finding ways for people to downsize into smaller, less expensive houses would be a better option rather than heading down this reverse mortgage path, which, I mean, I just can't see Treasury's the government of this persuasion or the previous persuasion wanting to get into the space of providing reverse mortgages and building up a large real estate holding, partial real estate holding, across the country.
What are some of those disincentives, as you see them, for people to downsize when the time is right?
Well, I think certainly the costs involved are significant, so the state charges around stamp duty and commissions and so forth are a significant issue. The absence of stock for people to move into that is both senior age-friendly but also is in an area, an environment, in a community that they're familiar with. The reality at the moment is if in most capital cities you choose to try and downsize and keep some cash out of the exercise, you'll end up moving to the back blocks where your access to services will be substantially diminished, and certainly you'll be in a community situation where you don't have, you know, your family doctor, your dentist, your baker, and your community there to support you. So real disincentives about stock and availability and accessibility become a real issue.
At the end of the day, though, the issue here is the cost of and long-term affordability of aged care for all of us as we become seniors. If you don't want the family home touched, either via an asset test or a reverse mortgage, then how can and will we be able to cover the costs of aged care down the track?
Well, I think we need to put the issue of cost and particularly the pension into perspective. So it's projected to rise between now and 2050 from 2.7% of GDP to 3.9% of GDP. So that's a relatively small rise, and that 3.9% is a half, a third, a quarter of what it will be in a range of European countries. So let's put some perspective around that. I think the second part is certainly in terms of the productivity element for older Australians as they prepare and head for retirement. That is the chance to maximise their retirement income situation. So yes, they are less dependent on the pension. I would suggest Mr. Howes particularly would be better placed to tackle the issue of employment opportunities for older Australians. And I don't mean folk in their 60s and 70s, I mean folk in their 50s. At the moment, if you are age 55, Natasha, and you lose your job, you're out of work for 72 weeks. Now, that kind of impact on your capacity to provide superannuation and retirement income and so forth is where we need to focus the attention rather than the low-hanging fruit of the family home.
Well, I'm sure many people would agree with focusing on employment opportunities. John Daly, final comment to you.
I think that this is something that we have to think about, and the things that Michael mentions are absolutely things we should look at in terms of ensuring that people over 55 have employment opportunities. That said, we've seen an increasing number of older Australians working over the last 30 years. It's been quite a big social shift. So we're already heading in that direction. That said, the age pension is a very large chunk of the federal budget. As you mentioned, it's 10% of what the federal government spends money on. That's a big chunk. And to simply put it off the table and say, oh, well, we're not going to look at it, is something that we cannot afford to do when the federal budget is under the pressure that it is.
Well, we no doubt will track this whole discussion very closely over the coming year or so. John Daly, CEO of the Grattan Institute, and also Michael O'Neill, Chief Executive of National Seniors Australia. Thanks for teasing out some of your perspectives on this issue.
Thanks, Natasha.
Oh, look, you're expressing your views on this one on Facebook. Let me tell you, Margaret's written, this will just stop people aiming for home ownership. A whole generation of renters and investors is what will happen. Just one of the many views, on the whole, I think, against, actually, the house being means tested for the pension. But get in touch on our Facebook page. And you can find that from our homepage, abc.net.au/rn, and look for Life Matters. It's all there, including our listener line. Our Twitter feed, @RNLifeMatters, is our Twitter handle. Love to hear from you on this vexed discussion. Well, on Life Matters next with me, Natasha Mitchell, here on RN, the Happy Wives Club.
Meet the ABC Radio app. It gives you access to RN on your phone, along with 19 other ABC radio networks, including local radio, news radio, Classic FM, Triple J, and all our digital-only stations. The ABC Radio app also has program schedules, links to our current ABC emergency coverage. It's free. Download it by searching ABC Radio app and take ABC Radio with you on your phone.
Now to the author of a book that has only just debuted at number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list as an antidote to the assumption that marriages the world over are in trouble, and programs like Desperate Housewives, which really give marriage quite a bad rap. The steadily rising divorce rate certainly gives some weight to that assumption, though, perhaps. Fawn Weaver's own happy marriage prompted her to form what she's called the Happy Wives Club. It's a global online club which really seems to have struck a chord with many, many people, including Australians. And she really wanted to distill what she thinks makes a marriage fulfilling. Though with a name like the Happy Wives Club, is she taking us back to the 1950s? I'm pleased to say Fawn joins us on the line from LA right now. Welcome to Life Matters and to the ABC, Fawn.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, what really prompted you to reflect on what you perceive to be a widespread negative view about marriage?
Well, I think one of the things, and one of the reasons it's resonating with people, is that we as women, we should not feel as though we're going back to the 50s to say we love our spouse or we adore our spouse. There should be nothing wrong with that. It doesn't take away from our ability to really climb the corporate ladder or to have the corner office. For me, when I began, I was a hotel general manager for Hilton. So that is the boys' club.
Sure is. Boys
club. So we're not talking about, you know, someone who thinks that going back to the 50s is a good idea. I assure you, I do not. But I do think that as strong women, we should be able to feel strong and adore at the same time. Our workplace should not take the place of love in our hearts.
When you looked around, what were the messages that you were getting about marriage that were contrary to your own relationship with your husband, Keith?
Well, they came in loud and clear here, especially in the media that informs so much of how we look and consider the world around us. So here, I don't know if it's the same there in Australia, but the Real Housewives have sort of taken over, and they've turned us into caricatures. And then you have basketball wives and football wives and every wife you can imagine. And for me, I just love being a wife, and I love being a woman who fully embraces her femininity, and I think there's a great deal of strength in that, not weakness.
What do you love about being a wife, particularly a wife?
What I love most is having a partner in this world that I can go twice the distance with. I mean, whenever I have really challenging days with what I do, they come sometimes, and just having that shoulder to place my head means everything in the world to me. Knowing I'm not in this alone, this world can be a little crazy, and knowing I have a partner that has my back, that is one of the greatest gifts.
Now, Fawn, surely though, you will be as aware as most that divorce statistics speak to something potentially very problematic about the expectations we have of marriage and the reality of marriage for many, many people.
I think that what the divorce rates actually state is we have a disposability problem. So we live in an age where we get rid of a television before it's actually time for it to go. We change out our computers, we change out our phones, even when they're working perfectly. And unfortunately, we're starting to do the same thing or have been doing the same thing with marriage. So rather than putting in the effort needed and required to really create the life and the marriage that we want, so many come out of it, go into another one, and I know that you know the divorce rate goes up substantially when you're in your second marriage or in your third marriage. So if you're looking at the divorce rates alone, they actually argue in the favor of making it work in your first marriage.
So
but you do have to put in the effort.
One key for you then, and you are a list maker. you give people lots of lists, 12 secrets of a great marriage, all sorts of lists. But one of the items on nearly every list seems to be have no plan B, and that is don't give yourself the option of divorce. Now, clearly this is dangerous. If a marriage is abusive or deeply, profoundly oppressive for either partner.
Absolutely, and there's no place that you'll ever see me say that where I don't say exactly what you just said. So when you're talking about a relationship, a marriage, where there is love, where there is respect, we're not talking about a marriage that's riddled in infidelity or abuse. Absolutely not. But what happens with so many is when something isn't 100% right, rather than working on that, rather than putting the effort there, then we begin subconsciously kind of putting a plan B in place. And whenever you put a plan B in place, you sort of make it necessary to have a plan B. And for all of the couples that I've interviewed around the world that have been happily married 25, 30, 40 years, 12 countries, 6 continents, I've been doing these interviews. I've surveyed well over 10,000 women that are happily married, and this is a constant, is that they threw divorce out of the equation, and when you take it out of the equation, then you don't have to resolve every single issue immediately. There doesn't have to be a meeting of the minds right at that moment, because you've already said you will be together until the end. So it buys you some time to work things out and to get it right.
Fawn Weaver is with me this morning. Now, she set up, in response to her own happy marriage, the First Wives Club. The Happy Wives Club, I should say. I'm getting mixed up with the film. That's classic. Bet you radio announcers have done that before. The Happy Wives Club is a global online community. Definitely not the First Wives Club. Look, one of the... There are lots of things that people will push back at in your lists, because one of the recommendations you make, which I think people will find disturbing, is that you say, as a woman, if you're married to your husband, you should ditch your friends of the opposite sex. You dropped your Facebook male friends. Now, what is that about, Fawn?
Okay, so one, let's backtrack to what's actually in the book, which is I'm talking about something that I chose to do, but I clearly state in the book that it was a decision that I made before I got married, before I even married my husband, because I was watching so many people around me that began dropping like flies, because the moment they had challenges with their spouse, rather than focusing on what it takes to make that work, they would run into the arms of familiarity. And because I personally had so many friends that were ex-boyfriends, I saw that danger. So it was a decision I made for myself. It's not one that I necessarily recommend for other people, unless you think that that could be a challenge. But that's something that I made for myself, and I don't regret it at all. And I have to tell you, from that point forward, I have seen so many marriages around me fall because friends have stayed in touch with exes over Facebook.
But exes are one thing. Exes are one thing, but isn't it a tragic limiting of your friendships to not have male friends?
I have male friends that are married. And it's, again, it is a decision.
So you won't let yourself have male friends. You won't let yourself have male friends who are single.
Oh, I have my husband for that. So if I'm going to hang out with someone, I want to hang out with my husband. I don't want to hang out with another single guy. No, I think that we're on two different pages. And I personally don't think there's anything wrong with that. This is true.
So one of the other arguments you make is that you have a zero tolerance policy, as you describe it, when it comes to your friends complaining about their husband. What are you getting at there in terms of interrogating that dynamic?
Well, a couple things. One, I think that maybe this might be coming from, possibly, from an article that was written, not necessarily from the book, because in the book itself, I actually don't give advice at all. In the book, we are following my journey as I learn these things from couples that have been happily married 25, 30, 40 years. I'm not personally giving any advice of my own. And one of the common denominators with all of the couples around the world is that they did not sit among other couples who spoke negatively of each other. If they would not sit in complaining sessions And wives, if you had other friends, it doesn't mean that you can't say, my husband did this wrong, or you can't be frustrated with your husband. That's not what it's saying. What it's saying is when a person brings that toxic nature into your relationship by constantly pointing out what males as a whole or husbands as a whole do. Mm. So those complaint sessions among wives, I'll tell you the problem that it happens because of them, is when one wife begins complaining, the other wives find reasons to complain just to be a part of the conversation. And so I can say that one of the most popular blog posts I've ever written to this day, from the time I started in 2010, was one called Change the Conversation. And in that, I challenged wives, when you are in a group of women that are all complaining about their marriages, be the one to change that conversation for the positive, to point out the things that are great about that person's spouse, to point out the reasons why that person chose that one out of the other 7 billion in the world they had to choose from. And I got so much positive feedback from wives saying, you know what, I usually am the one in that conversation trying to find something to point out that my husband does wrong just so I could be a part.
Well, this is part of the thread of optimism in your argument, I guess. And you did, as you point out, for the book, travel from South Australia to South Africa, Italy, Mauritius, South America, Canada, Fiji, here to Perth, and all across the world, and connecting people's stories and experiences. And certainly, if we pull back into the relationship itself, one of them is that you see as key is to accept each other's differences.
Absolutely, because we are different. And even when you're looking at a little girl and a little boy, take them at just the age of 6, before the world has had a chance to really pour into them, and just look at how different we are. So then we get to become adults, and then all of a sudden we want to pretend we should be the same. We're not the same. We're wired differently. And being able to accept that about one another, being able to accept that we are different and it's okay. I have a friend who says this quote that I absolutely love. And she says, if both of us are the same, then, or if the two of us are identical, then one of us is unnecessary. And I think the beauty of marriage is you have two people that are different, that bring two completely different things to the table, and celebrating those differences is important.
Well, what are some of the differences that you've had to wrestle with in your own marriage that you're prepared to share with us? You know, things that
go ahead.
Yeah, things that you've really had to struggle with and work through. And clearly, for you, this is about conversation and partnership. It's not just you changing here, I hope, because I am concerned that much of your emphasis is on women, on wives, and them modifying their behaviour.
No, there is no modification whatsoever. Again, the book itself is just a connecting of the dots of what works in marriage and what makes happy marriages around the world, the common denominators. These women are strong. They're as strong as I am. You have in one country, you're talking about one of the top plastic surgeons in the world, and another one of the top ophthalmologists, and another a travel writer. These are not doormats we're talking about here, nor are they women who have modified who they are. I would say my biggest internal struggle is I am a bit of a fire piston. I left home when I was 15 years old, and so I am incredibly strong-willed. And so one of the things that I had to learn in getting married is I'm not always right.
Damn it.
There is someone else who can be right. It doesn't mean that all of a sudden I'm saying I'm always wrong. It just means that sometimes I don't have to be right. But the Happy Wives Club is, if you read the book, it's very similar in style to Eat, Pray, Love. You're taking a journey with me. You're meeting couples along the way. At no point am I suggesting that anyone change their behavior or modify what they believe. This is solely the consistencies that I found and these couples around the world. And celebrating each other's differences were huge. I tell you what else was huge, and it was the biggest point that is mentioned throughout the book and the the thread that could not be missed is mutual respect was clear in every single relationship.
Mutual respect.
Mutual. There was not more respect between the husband toward the wife or the wife toward the husband. It was even. If you look at these men, they doted over their wives, and they were not ashamed to do that.
Go ahead. No, you go.
The wives didn't have to brag on their successes because their husbands were their biggest cheerleaders. And so I talk about that throughout the book. And what's been great is that as wives have been reading the book, they've been sharing those pieces with their husbands. And I think that this is an important piece for husbands to get. But I also don't expect for husbands to read a book called The Happy Wives Club, which is why it's written to women.
They just might like to. I don't know. How much of this, Fawn Weaver, this argument that you're promoting and the movement that has grown online via the website, how much of this is shaped by your Christian values? You suggest in the book that you're not overtly political or religious in voice, but this is obviously a big part of who you are.
It absolutely is a huge part of who I am as a person. But I tell you what, one of the reasons why this journey is not following my marriage, but versus following all of these other couples, is I want it to have every religion represented. I want it to have agnostics represented, because a happy marriage is not based on religion. And that was very clear when I was traveling the world. It is based on a love, a respect. Having a faith in God was absolutely important to all, and a higher power. But for me personally, my marriage is incredibly important to me, because this is what I want to pass down to my children. Whether or not that comes from Christian values, I don't know. But I do know that it's something that I hope to pass down.
And friendship? Friendship seems to be at the heart of it for you too. And I wonder whether people forget to be friends when they've got kind of caught up in the regimens of raising the children together. And we should point out, you don't have children. So, and certainly children and the mismatch in domestic loads and responsibilities can be a big source of sustained tension for families and for couples.
Well, I think that a couple of things. One, it is good to point out that I don't have children, but it's also good to point out the reason I don't have children is for infertility reasons.
Yes.
And so we have gone through several rounds of infertility treatment. As soon as I'm done with the media tour, I will be back in the doctor's office, and he'll be doing another one, and we'll have all the hormones in my system and all that fun stuff. Yeah. So fertility issues is a huge problem for marriages. And so the fact that we have been able to maintain this relationship and this friendship in spite of that, I think that has to be said also. But one of the things that I discovered in talking to all of these couples, I have to tell you, there was a bit of fear in me about what will happen when we have children, because I hear so many people saying exactly what you just said, which is how so much changes and how difficult it gets. And the thing that I loved about these couples is they basically said, listen, you can always find an excuse for it not to work. You can always find an excuse to not be happy in your marriage. The key is in finding an excuse to be happy and to put in the effort. And they all had really great ways of managing their housework and the children being raised, which, by the way, mommies and daddies split this in this book. This is not something that is all of a sudden goes to one side of the sex. This is a joint effort. These are couples who are friends. These are couples who have managed to remain in love for all of these years, and I think they're worth listening to.
Well, and you certainly have listened to them, thousands of them, as it seems. And look, I really thank you for joining us on the line from LA this morning. Fawn Weaver, thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Fawn Weaver, she is the founder of the Happy Wives Club, which is also the name of a book, and we'll pop the details on the Life Matters website. Hey, Michael Cathcart.
Hey, Natasha. We're going to talk to Wesley Enoch, who's the Artistic Director of the Queensland Theatre Company, coming up on Books and Arts Daily. He's caught up in a whisk of controversy about a joke about Campbell Newman that he cut from a play. cut from a political satire. I think he put it back last night. We'll find out. Anyway, we're going to find out why that joke got cut.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that discussion very much. That's Books and Arts Daily straight after the news with Michael Cathcart. And we're going to head to the Winter Olympics tomorrow. It's about to open, as we know. Going to meet a guy who has spent a lot of time in the snow from tropical Australia. Here's the news.